and welcome to another exciting episode of SFP Now. This is our first live episode with interview. It's also our first Friday live episode that we've done on here in about 2 years, so it's real exciting. Joining me, as always, is Raisa, and we're going to go through some news bits before we get to the interview. The interview this weekend is with Terric Marcel, the creator of Hawk the Slayer. And, you know, he's done all sorts of work in film and television over the years. You know, he's got a career that spans about 50 years. So, you know, he could probably tell you stuff about... He's probably forgotten more about television than we'll ever know. But before we get to that, we're going to go over some of the news. And I'll start one, then we'll hand over to Reese for one, and we'll just do it in sequence like we always try to. First bit of news, this is probably only applicable to the UK DVD and Blu-ray market right now. I'm not sure when it will be released in the US. It'll probably be pretty soon. But basically, the film Mr. Holmes, which stars Ian McKellen, is going to be available here in the UK on Blu-ray and DVD from the 26th of October. The film stars Academy Award nominee Ian McKellen, who takes on the role of Detective Sherlock Holmes, one of British literature's most iconic characters in the film, which is simply titled Mr. Holmes. In 1947, the world-famous sleuth has retired to a remote Sussex farmhouse, living in relative anonymity with only his housekeeper, Mrs. Munro, and her young son, Roger, for company. Cantankerous, demanding and frustrated with the misrepresentation of him in Watson's best-selling novels, he diverts his attention to an unsolved case. As the mystery deepens, Sherlock tries desperately to recall the events of 30 years ago that ultimately led to his retirement. Starring Academy Award nominee Laura Linney, The Savages, as housekeeper Mrs. Munro, Francis Detour from Harry Potter, and newcomer Milo Parker. Mr. Holmes is adapted from Mitch Cullen's 2005 novel, A Slight Trick of the Mind, and is directed by Academy Award-winning filmmaker Bill Condon, who directed Gods and Monsters. The UK DVD includes extras, which include interview with the cast, Ian McKellen, Laura Linney, Hiroki Sanada, and Milo Parker, and interviews with the crew, director Bill Condon, novelist Mitch Cullen, and costume designer Keith Madden. So what do you reckon to that?
I'm looking forward to it. I'm definitely going to rent it when it's available here. I've been looking forward to that movie for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of curious about it. I mean, the only things I've seen of Sherlock Holmes where he's a much older man were the Christopher Lee ones that were done in the early 90s.
Mm.
And they were kind of so-so. They weren't great.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well...
I'm
going to cue you in. Talking about classic literature, Raisa has got a bit of a news bit.
Yes, if Daredevil is classic literature, and for many it is, I've got a piece of casting news that just came out today, according to Deadline. Marvel's Daredevil has cast Steven Ryder as a regular for season 2. Steven Ryder will play a character by the name of Blake Tower, who's Caucasian, and he'll be joining the series as a district attorney for New York City who helps Charlie Cox's Daredevil, a lawyer and civilian identity as Matt Murdock, with information to help track down and capture criminals.
Cool.
Well, that should be cool.
I'm quite looking forward to seeing a Punisher in that series.
Yeah, John Bernthal should be cool in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, while we're sort of interesting on the subject of classic literature. This is a story I was hoping Reyes would go with. Basically, two classic Doctor Who actresses are going to help Dorian Gray celebrate Christmas for Big Finish.
Oh, yes, yes. And it's going to be a... it's going to be a double set. It's going to be two adventures with Dorian Gray. And the conceit of the series is that Dorian Gray was a real character who is wandering around the present day, having been immortal. And he helped inspire the book, bearing mm-hmm. his name and his story. And you've got Katie Manning and Sophie Aldred in supporting roles in the two disc set for Big Finish, available this December. And you've also got Gabriel Wolfe, who plays Sutek so memorably in the Fourth Doctor's era as one of the villains.
Mm-hmm.
So Sutek
also featured in the recent Big Finish release of can't remember the title of it, but it was Sutek.
It was Bernice Summerfield, The Triumph of Sutek.
That's the one. Yeah. And that was
awesome,
absolutely fantastic.
Yes.
But yeah, it's great to see that, you know, Katie Manning still able to play Jo Grant, but she's also able to play these other roles as well. Talking which, I seen her a few months back. She was in an episode of Casualty here in the UK.
Mm.
And
yeah,
it was so... Okay.
Yeah, I really like the fact that that the Big Finish folks have this sort of basically a repertory company of audio actors that just keep going through all of these, and it's kind of heartwarming.
Mm-hmm.
This should be very good.
And we've got some great stuff coming up as well, including the new series of Doctor Who. They've got a special new unit series starting, which is kind of going to tie into the new series. I'm not sure to what extent it will tie in.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell. With the unit stuff and with River Song and with Strax and Jago and Lightfoot, I the impression I get is that the BBC is tacitly informing the world that they're out of the spin-off business and just shunting all that stuff over to Big Finish. But I could be wrong.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yes, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, I think, with it. Talking of which, these sort of like have got a bit of Star Wars stuff going on here. But before we go on to that, as we mentioned earlier in the week, I think we might have done it on the website, they're releasing the new Star Wars stuff this week, and quite a lot of it's come out because I pre-ordered quite a few pop vinyls of the new Star Wars characters, which include Kylo Ren, the First Order Stormtrooper, Finn, BB-8, and I think it's Captain Phasma. They've all come out in the in pop vinyl bobbleheads form.
Awesome.
So that's cool. And they've released all the figures as well. They've released a new version, the Millennium Falcon, which comes with two figures. It's all looking great. But while we're on Star Wars, another story that's just come to light, and this is coming from the Hollywood Reporter, Star Wars Speed Read, how the first new novel ties into Force Awakens. And we've got a nice little picture of Darth Vader here. Looking all proud because his helmet's sort of looking up to the sky. Kind of looks cute. it's not just the remains of the Empire that might cause trouble for Luke, Leia and all in the future. For those looking to discover more about the forces of darkness in this winter's Star Wars Force Awakens should pick up the newly released Star Wars Aftermath, the first canonical release of to reveal what happened after the events of 1983's Return of the Jedi. It turns out there's more than just the Empire for the good guys to worry about. Spoilers follow. Shall we read the spoilers?
I go ahead.
I'm going for it. I'm going for it. I'm a big kid on Christmas morning with anything Star Wars. Aftermath, the first of a trilogy of prose novels by Chuck Wendig, doesn't just feature a meeting of surviving Imperial officials trying to decide the fate of the Empire following the fall of the Emperor, a discussion that includes one participant suggesting that the remaining Imperial forces go in search of the origins of the dark side of the Force. Fascinatingly enough, it also introduces a group calling themselves the Acolytes of the Beyond. The Acolytes appear in one of many interludes showing what's happening throughout the galaxy in the book, and others including the creation of a new republic as the Rebel Alliance try to fill the vacuum left by the Empire, as well as scenes set on planets where natives are attempting to overthrow Imperial rule. Amongst those planets, Naboo, Coruscant, and Kashyyyk, that last planet being the home planet of Chewbacca, meaning that both Chewie and Han show up in the book preparing for a fight. Other movie characters making appearances include Admiral Ackbar and Mon Mothma from Return of the Jedi, and Wedge Antilles, an ancillary character played by Dennis Lawson in every movie of the original trilogy, that gets bumped up to a leading role this time around, unfortunately for him. In their debut appearance, the Acolytes are seen purchasing what is claimed to be a lightsaber once owned by Darth Vader. Their reason for wanting it? We will destroy it, one of the Acolytes explains, so that it can be returned to its master in death. That's worth noting because in a recent interview, Star Wars Force Awakens director J.J. Abrams revealed that Kylo Ren, Adam Driver's villain in the new movie, isn't a Sith, and asked the tantalizing question, could Vader be a martyr? To some, it seems, the answer would appear to be yes. The only question now is, what will the Acolytes get up to next? And that's it.
Cool.
Interesting.
Yeah, because there was in one of the Entertainment Weekly interviews I sent you earlier, it had a thing on Kylo Ren, and it mentioned that he actually made his own lightsaber, and that's why his looks so different from everybody else's.
Mhm. Yeah, so I think you've got something as well, haven't you?
Yes, and speaking of lightsabers and costumes for Arrow fans, given a mixed reaction to this, I sent you a link to the picture through the message on Skype. Diggle's costume has been released, and he looks like Magneto's brother from another mother. I'm going to have to see how this looks on the screen in motion, but somewhere between intent and execution, the PR rollout has been received with mixed reviews.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't quite look right.
Okay. I've got another bit of comic books news here. And basically, this is literally comic book news, so it's not to do with a TV series or anything. But I should imagine it might actually eventually roll into a TV series, knowing Marvel. You know, certainly animated. But basically, Marvel has revealed the new totally awesome Hulk. And he's Korean American, and it basically says teenage genius Amadeus Cho gets the gamma radiated genes in new series this winter. Marvel Entertainment's move towards a more diverse lineup continues with Friday's confirmation that the company's new comic book Hulk will be fan favorite character Amadeus Cho, giving the Marvel Universe its first Korean-American leading man. Cho, who first appeared in 2006's Amazing Fantasy No. 15, has previously served as a supporting character in both the Incredible Hulk and Incredible Hulk series, written by character co-creator Greg Pak. A teenage prodigy of genius intellect, he's previously been shown to butt heads with other supervillains superheroes in the cause of the greater good, or at least a greater good as he sees it. And that before he's fully thought through the consequences of his actions, which is somewhat ironic for one of the self-proclaimed smartest people on the planet. Pak returns to write Cho in the Totally Awesome Hulk series with art by Frank Cho. In a statement accompanying the reveal of the new Hulk's identity, Marvel Editor-in-Chief Axel Alonso said that Cho would differ from earlier Hulks because he'll carry the burden of being the Hulk like it weighs a feather. He's going to love every minute of it. Cho's placement will continue Marvel's attempts to diversify its mainline heroes. Last year, some saw Sam Wilson, previously the Falcon, become Captain America, while Thor was replaced by Jane Foster as God of Thunder at the same time. Additionally, the upcoming or new or different Marvel relaunch of the company's comic book line will see the African-American Miles Morales join Peter Parker as one of two Spider-Men swinging around New York City. The company has yet to reveal what has happened to Bruce Banner prior to the series launch, or whether Cho will be the only Hulk in the Marvel Universe when the series begins this December. Personally, I can't see that.
No. I'm not as versed in the Hulk as some of the other Marvel stuff, but there are multiple Hulks in the Hulk universe operating at one time with mm-hmm. different backstories. So I could see why you could have more than one and just focus on a different one for a bit and then have them work together maybe.
Yeah, well, we have had the Red Hulk, you know, That's a different Hulk. We've had She-Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I can't see that, you know, there's room for another Hulk, I think.
Yeah. Especially if they need to appeal to a different demo.
Yep. But, you know, so, like, it's kind of a weird one because the fact that they're changing it up so much is going to be upsetting a lot of Marvel purists.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I find it funny listening to, you know, certain people go off on these tangents. I mean, it's so, like, it's a bit like, what I find funny, and I still find it funny to this day, is Idris Elba as Heimdall.
Yes, whiter than white, applies to his spirit,
yes.
So that still works.
Yeah, you know, sort of like, but, you know, a lot of the Marvel fans took that literally to mean whiter than white, that he's supposed to be an albino. And I think in Norse mythology, he was an albino, but the whiter than white was mostly referring to his spirit, like you say.
Yes.
So do you have anything else?
Nope, that was it.
Okay, well, I think this is actually a good time to play the interview. So, without further ado, this is Terry Marcel interview that I've recently done. We'll warn you about something. We do mention the fact that he was at Fright Fest, which was last weekend. So, you know, disregard that bit because it's already happened. But don't disregard the fact that there's a Kickstarter campaign for Heart of the Hunter because quite a few of us here at Sci-Fi Pulse and SFP now would love to see that film made.
Yes.
So without further ado, here is Terry Marcel.
Enough! Enough!
Two blood brothers out for each other.
You have found the power which is rightly mine. How?
The firstborn brother, they called him Voltan.
Enter, Dark One.
The devil's agent, the servant of evil.
Kill him!
The secondborn brother, They called him Hawk. He had one secret weapon, the ancient power of the Sword of Mind, and he was out for revenge.
I'd like to welcome director, writer, producer Terry Marcel to the show, who's going to be talking to us about Hawk the Slayer, among other things, including Hawk the Hunter. How are you doing, Terry?
Yeah, we're doing fine. We're hoping that everything's going to go well this coming 30th. That's when we go to Fright Fest. They're showing Hawk the Slayer there, and I'm up on the stage presenting it and then doing a Q&A afterwards, and that's where we're going to tell everybody about the Kickstarter program that's going to be launched on that day, and we'll be looking for the final piece of money for Hawk the Hunter, the sequel.
Mm-hmm. Cool. First off, I've got a few questions, namely about your career as well as Hawk the Slayer and various other things, if that's okay.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, first off, I know that you're actually from a family that's been involved with the film business, but I'm just wondering, how did you become interested in the film business and whatnot?
A very strange story, really. I mean, it's all about, isn't it, you know, what happens, what fate's got in store for you. My father moved to a little village in Coldbrook way back, I can't remember, about 59. And I was sort of, you know, not really doing anything, wasn't, you know, particularly interested in anything. And he said to me one day, he said, why don't you get on your bike and ride over to Pinewood Studios and try and get a job there as a runner or something. So I thought, well, why not? And I rode over to the studio and was stopped at the gate by security and a man called Morris there. And I said to him, look, I wonder if I could get a job here. And he said, look, just hold on a minute. And he called up the personnel officer there, who was kind enough to let me in and see him. And I met him, and he said, look, he said, you know, here's a list of people trying to get jobs as mailboys here. There's about 20 people on the list. He said, but I'll put you on the list if you like. He said, and, you know, who knows? And I got back on my bike and rode home. When I got home, the phone rang, and it was this man, Zeffie Harris. He said, look, you just came in to see me. He said, one of our mailboys can't come for a couple of weeks. The others don't seem to be available. Do you want to come in tomorrow and start? That's how I started.
Wow. I mean, you know, to be honest, to get into business now, you'd probably need to, have a university degree or have gone to film school or something. Whereas, you know, it sounds like it was, you know, probably a little bit more accessible back then.
I think it was, and don't forget that Pinewood was the school itself. I mean, when you started there as a third male boy, you were taught, you know, everything about filmmaking. So you went from third male boy to second male boy to first male boy. Then you were lucky enough to go to one of the departments that you'd chosen. You know, you could either go in camera, sound, or I wanted to be an assistant director. And so I went into the production department as a runner, third runner, second runner, first runner. And during that time, you're expected to learn everything about being a third assistant. And finally, you get your break to become a third assistant. And in those days, before you became a fully fledged member of the union, you had to go to a board of your peers, and they would vet you and decide whether or not you could come on board as a third assistant. And of course, from then onwards, you had to do so many years as a third, so many years as a second, before you could become a first assistant.
Mm-hmm. So it's more of an apprenticeship than anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and a good one too.
Maybe it should actually bring that sort of system back for a lot of the jobs that are around today.
Well, I wouldn't care to comment, but I have experienced some lack of knowledge in my particular area for people who've moved very fast to become first assistants and really don't have the background to do it. But there you go.
Okay. Well, I've read your IMDb profile. You've done, you know, it seems to me you've done a lot of television as well as film.
I have, yes.
And you've done sort of like lots of different genres, from children's television through to, sci-fi, fantasy and horror.
Yeah.
Now, if it wasn't just about paying the bills and you could actually pick any of those genres, which would it be, and what genre would you like to most explore?
There's only one genre for me, sword and sorcery.
Cool.
Absolutely number one, way out ahead of everything else.
Mm. Yeah, and it seems to me that there's still quite a lot that's not been done in that genre as well.
I totally agree with you. That's why I think that the sequel to Hulk the Slayer, Hulk the Hunter, is very sword and sorcery. It's very Fritz Lieber, very Conan, and I think that you know, this will be achieve some of the things I wanted to achieve, especially now that the technology, my script's caught up with the technology, or the technology's caught up with the script that we wrote. And of course, you know, in the long term, we've also been discussing a television series, which if the sequel goes well, then we'll go to a TV series.
Well, you know, I'm hoping that all works out, because I'd actually love to see a second Sonic Hawk film. I remember seeing the first one, the only one that you've done so far, and it was on a rather iffy video.
Yeah.
Admitting it back in 1983.
Well done.
And it was actually tagged on to the back end of Empire Strikes Back. I think long play video had just been invented back then, because somehow my brother's friend managed to get 2-3 films on this same tape.
Right.
And Hawk the Slayer was one of them. And I remember getting to the end of it and thinking, you know, there's definitely more scope and more stories that can be told here.
Yeah. Well, there has some. Well, I mean, since the inquiry into a TV series by a distribution company, and on the basis that the sequel does well, I had to go back and reinvent an awful lot of material, because the two scripts as they stand wouldn't really give you a big enough arc or a big enough storyline to support a television series. So I've reinvented a lot of the material, and I've based a lot of it now around the hilt of the sword, which is a green stone, the mind stone. Where did it come from? What does it do? What's its purpose? It's very much a different arc now to what it was.
So it's probably gone a little bit Sonic and Lord of the Rings, and you've got more of a history of the mind stone.
Exactly. More Sword of Shannara, I would say.
Yeah. You just said before that, you know, obviously he was influenced by the books of Robert E. Howard, who of course created Conan the Barbarian. So I read those books myself when I was in my teens. What would you say your other influences have been for the film story?
Well, strangely enough, the reason that I set out to do Hawk the Slayer was, it wasn't going to be a sword and sorcery. I'd been working with this with Harry Robertson, who was my partner on Hawk. He was doing the music for a couple of small movies I was doing, and one day I was chatting to him, and we talked about our love for some of the great Japanese movies. One in particular was Yojimbo, and I said to him, you know, Yojimbo was made into a fantastic, you know, Western, Pistol of Dollars. I said, but what I'm trying to do, I said, is I'm trying to turn it into a story about a, you know, a wandering knight who comes back from the Crusades. Same type of thing, you know, same type of look. I said, well, I'm going off to Spain for a couple of weeks. I said, when I come back, I'll have a script outlined, and we'll work on it together. Well, I went off to Spain, started to write it, and I had an incredible problem with the sword. The sword was always on the back, on his back, and I couldn't get it out. And I thought, how am I going to get this sword into his hand quickly? Because I wanted quick draw, really. And suddenly occurred to me, why don't I make it a magic sword? And from then onwards, it developed into a sword and sorcery story.
Cool. You know, it's also it's kind of funny because, you know, I briefly mentioned Star Wars to you before that, you know, the film was on the tail end of that. And, you know, the way his mind's connected to the sword, it could almost be it's very similar to the Force.
Indeed it is. And I now know why it does it, which I didn't know before. So it was one of the problems I had to solve when I wanted to take this further into a TV series. And, you know, so there are a lot of interesting reasons why the sword does what it does. I can tell you a little bit about the sequel. In the sequel, you find out that there are three stones like this. Two are one you saw in Hawk the Slayer, which the wizards have. Mm-hmm. One Hawk has, and there's a third one, which I can't tell you where that is at this point. And it's also about a dark sword. So before the Mind Sword was forged, there was another sword before it, which was so evil, so dark, that the troll that made it hid it away forever. And in this sequel, Voltan is risen from the dead by the wizards to find that sword, which they hope could destroy Hawk and bring them one of the other stones. That's as far as I'm going.
Cool. you know, that sort of makes sense because in the original, it was actually suggested that Votan, you know, would return.
It was indeed. We always had planned to have him return, but he doesn't return quite as he was. But again, you've got to see the movie to find out.
And we talked a little about the amazing cast that you managed to actually get for the original film. You had the likes of Roy Kinnear and Bernard Bresnel, who I actually loved as a giant. What were those people like to work with?
Fantastic. I mean, I was very lucky. I mean, I've got to admit that the small parts were played by really top-rate, excellent actors. And no, we had no problems at all. The actors were all lovely to work with. I mean, I was fortunate having worked with actors, you know, all my career as an assistant director. So, you know, I devised my own way of working and, you know, I went along with the, you know, very easy on set. You know, I like to keep a nice quiet set. I like to let the actors, you know, have the space to work in. And there was no problems with any of them. They were all great. In fact, you know, people like Roy Kinnear, who only had two or three lines, stole scenes. It was just fantastic. And with Hawk the Hunter, I'm hoping to do the same thing, to try and cast all the same types of roles with really good, great English actors.
Are we likely to see the original Hawk return?
No, I'm afraid not. John Terry, who's around a lot, he's on a boat in the South Pacific. Now, it'll be a new Hawk, a new Galt. There will be some familiar faces. Ray Charlson, who played the Killer Crow, he will be coming back as a new character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was my favorite from the original.
Yeah, well, he will be in the new one as an elf called Bowman, and there's a whole history about Bowman, and I've also reinvented him because I want to use him in a TV series as well. It becomes a very important character.
Cool, but you know, there's not that can be achieved now in fantasy movies that unfortunately that couldn't be achieved back when you made Hawk, you know, effects wise and stuff like that. Have you given any thought to sort of like the sort of effects that you're going to be wanting to use in the new film and series? Is it going to be mostly CGI? Or are you going to try and do a mix of both practical and CGI?
Well, we're very fortunate because I don't know if you know we've got a deal. Our co-producers on this are a company called Rebellion, who are a big games company in this country, and Jason Kingsley, who's the creative director. He's had some great ideas, and I think that we are going to use quite a bit of CGI, but we haven't changed anything that we originally written in terms of the CGI. It's just that I don't know how we thought we were going to do it all those years ago, but we are now able to do a lot of the stuff that I think we would have had a lot of trouble trying to do it back then. But what we want to do is, because the fans don't want us to wander too far from the original, so we are trying to keep it as close in style and look and ambition as we did Hawk the Slayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was actually amazed. I was reading the article in The Guardian about it, and I think you were talking about the effect with the sword, how literally you were literally having to throw the sword from one side of the set to the other.
Yeah.
And having watched the movie, you know, several times, I've actually got it on DVD, a proper legal copy. I often wondered how that was achieved because I didn't see any strings.
That's true.
Or anything like that. And, you know, not knowing that you threw it, it makes me wonder how on earth nobody got hurt.
John Terry and I practiced quite a lot. We spent most of our offset time. I had a particular way of holding the sword, and as I threw it, I span it, so it span through the air, and he would practice catching it. And we got pretty good at it. So most of it, all the effects, obviously, those were either in camera. They were all in camera. There was the only things that were outside of camera were the mats, which were the painted mats of various sets. That was all.
Wow. I mean, you know, it's amazing to look back on it now. I mean, it's, you know, and you know, some of the matte paintings were pretty damn impressive for the film.
I was fortunate because having worked at Pinewood for so many years and being an old Pinewood boy, they were very good to me, the studios. They more or less let me have carte blanche, you know, with I could use what I liked for sets. And the matte painter, I can't remember his name, he was one of the greatest matte painters we've ever had. And he was at Pinewood, and he was you know, we were lucky enough to have him come on board and do them for us.
Cool. Another aspect to the of the film that I loved a lot was music. And you've actually got Rick Wakeman working with you on the music for the new film. I'm just wondering what sort of conversations have you had with Rick about that?
It was fantastic to get him, really. I mean, it was such a coup. I mean, I didn't realise that my partner had contacted him, Andrew, and the moment he said Hawk the Slayer to him, Rick went, "It's my favourite film. I'm an absolute lunatic fan. Yes, I've got to do the music." And so we arranged a meeting, and it was wonderful meeting him. I mean, I don't think I could ever replace Harry, because Harry was brilliant. He was, you know, he was absolutely fantastic. But if I had to replace him with somebody, Rick Maitland's the person I want to replace him with.
Mm-hmm. Are you shooting for a similar sort of like style of music, or are you going for a bit of a more modern?
We're the same sort of style, but obviously we want to bring it up to date a little bit. But, you know, a lot of that I'm going to leave to Rick, because I think he's already got fantastic ideas.
Cool. I mean, you know, it's like, is the original soundtrack available?
Yes, I believe it is. I mean, I know that I often get requests to sign the original vinyl version of it. I don't think there's too many of those around, but I think you still can buy a vinyl version on online.
I'd be after something more CD or digital, because I don't have a record player.
I don't know. I mean, I think the music's controlled by Sony. I don't know. I couldn't help you there.
That's too bad. Obviously, you know, it's pretty obvious now that you're, as always, hoping to revisit Hawk, you know, based on the fact that you've got so much happening with it. And, you know, you mentioned the games company Rebellion, you know, you were helping finance the film.
Yes.
Does that mean we could maybe see a Hawk video game in development with the film as well as comic books?
Absolutely. I think that's their main interest. You know, that they have taken the games rights and the publishing rights. So, yes, you know, Jason is a mad keen Hawks fan, and he believes there's a great amount of people out there would like to play the game.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm probably one of them. You know, I like I like to play the odd video game when I actually have a 4-hour block free to do so, which hardly ever happens.
I know.
But it's a story, swords and sorcery, and that sort of thing lends itself really well to video games. I mean, you know, you've only got to look at things like EverQuest and such to know that.
That's also one of the reasons I think he was interested in it, because I'd expanded the story so much. I mean, it's really a huge canvas now. You know, there are, you know, lots of different things in it, lots of different peoples now that we will get to meet if we get into a TV series. So, it is much bigger than it ever was.
Cool. I can't wait. I'm hoping that we can actually get this extra funding for you. Although you actually have so much backing from Rebellion, how much do you actually need to find? I know that it's 20% of the budget, but how much is that work out?
We need $1 million.
$1 million. So that's what, about 700,000, 800,000?
Something like that, yeah. So, you know, it's a big target to aim for, but it's the only way I think we're going to ever put this, put this sequel up there. If the fans gather around and say, "Guys, we've got to see it, put your money in and we'll go make it for you."
Cool. So what kind of things are available to those that want a pledge to the film?
Look, that's being dealt with by Andrew, my partner, and that will be up on the Kickstarter site on the 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some very, very good things. There is one thing I can tell you. Yes, I know one thing. I'm not directing, actually, this movie. I've got a younger guy I've been working with who's going to direct it, but I am going to do what we call a fan day. And there's a huge fight scene in an inn with Gull and the new Hanfer, he's the new dwarf, and a changeling called Grey Rook. And I'm going to shoot that day, and any fan that wants to come along, it's a reward. You can buy this reward. You can come along. You can be in the scene, and you can get your head punched out, if you like. And I'll be directing that scene. So that's one of the things we're offering up.
It sounds awesome.
A lot of the press people have already said they want to be there for that day, So it is going to be a big day, but, you know, and it's just time for me to come out of retirement and do that one big scene.
you know, I'm really hoping that we can help you raise this money. I myself will be pledging something towards it.
Well, that's very good of you. I really appreciate it, Ian. Thank you.
Because I really want to see this film made, because the thing that I loved about the original is, you know, it was a good humoured adventure. I mean, it was on one hand, it was kind of like a very dark story, but it was kind of like I enjoyed a lot of the scenes between the giant and the elf character.
Yeah, well, you'll get a lot more of that in this. We've stuck very much to the same sort of structure. So there's still a lot going on between the giant and the new character is called Hanfer. He's another dwarf. And there's a lot of comedy in it, you know, and I think that's important with these sort of movies. You don't want to get too serious. And listen, I want mum and dad to take their two kids to see this.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I was about 13 when I seen the original.
So. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the sort of age we would aim for.
Okay, well, Terry, thanks a lot for your time. As you said, Kickstarter is going to be starting on the 30th.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I'll be at Fright Fest for anybody who wants to see me.
Okay, well, you know, hopefully we can, you know, help get a few people down there for you.
Thanks, Ian, I really appreciate it, and anything else you need, don't hesitate to let me know.
Will do, and thanks a lot for your time, Terry. It's been really fantastic speaking to you, and best of luck raising the funds. You know, I really hope that this happens to you.
Thanks very much, Ian, and once again, as I said, anything I can do, just give me a call.
Good night.
Take care, mate. Bye.
Together, they took on the mighty Voltan. Together, they took on the devil's agent. Two blood brothers with only blood between them. Beyond the edge of darkness, there is a world of sword and sorcery.
And that was our interview with Terry Martell. Obviously, Fright Fest was unfortunate last weekend. We had a few technical problems, putting all this together. So we ended up having to go out a week late. But if you are interested in learning more about the film, there is a website for it, which is www.hawkthehunter.com. And you can also find it on Kickstarter. In fact, I should imagine there will be a link to the Kickstarter on the hawkthehunter.com website. I'd like to thank Raisa for, you know, helping out with the news a bit earlier on, although it was pretty apparent we weren't on the same page a few times. And also like to thank Terry for giving up his valuable time to actually take time out and talk to us. As of this moment, the actual Kickstarter campaign, it's raised thus far $19,000, and it's only been up since Sunday of last week. So it's not doing too badly, but it needs more people to go in there and pledge to make this film happen. And I'm really hoping it does happen. I mean, so like. Terry actually tells me he's already got 4.5 million towards the film's budget, but the 500,000 they're asking for on Kickstarter will push them over the edge and make the film a reality. So, you know, if you have the time to check it out and go there and pledge, there's loads of fantastic rewards on offer. There's actually I was looking at it yesterday, to be honest, and there's actually a sword, this replica of the Mind Sword, and I think there's five of these going, and I think it's for one of the higher pledges. And I'll tell you what, I wish I could afford one of the higher pledges, because I'd get myself that damn sword. It's cool. Unfortunately, it doesn't include the ability to sort of like telepathically call it into your hand sort of thing, but it's just an exact replica of the swords that they use in the film. Anyway, that's about all we've got time for this week. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. The interview we have next week is with Mark Millar. who has wrote such brilliant comics as Kick-Ass, Nemesis, Kingsman Secret Service, Superior. There's endless amount of comics this guy's written. He also pretty much helped Marvel out of a sticky situation back in the 90s with his updated version of the Avengers, the Ultimates. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to playing that interview and let you guys hear it. But that's about all we've got time for this week. Before I go, I'd like to make a quick mention. We're part of the League of Geeks network. We've got two other shows on the League of Geeks, two other channels. We have Genretainment, which you can get to at blogtalk.com/genretainment. That's spelt GENRETAINMENT. Just for those that might be asking. And we also have Super Geeked Up, which is hosted by our imperious leader, Jeff Burns. And that is at blogtalkradio.com/Super Geeked Up. And I think Super Geeked Up actually has new episodes on there as of now. So it's worth checking out. Anyway, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you enjoy the show. Feel free to comment with ideas and requests and whatever, and we'll try and make them happen. But that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks a lot, and we'll catch you next week.